In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
Well, I'm going to go into a several-minute silence because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you guys a wonderful report. Take it away.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere, stay with me.
At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line.
All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Now, thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Dema. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Many thanks for that fantastic adventure. That wraps up our program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been Samson Seas. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A record number of children and young people in England are seeking help for mental health problems. We take a look at some of the press and world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to data laying bare the impact of lengthy waiting lists for regular National Health Service treatment, the number of children referred to emergency mental health care in England has soared by more than 50% in 3 years. Analysis of official data by the Royal College of Psychiatrists revealed there were 32,521 emergency and urgent referrals to child and adolescent mental health services crisis teams in 2022-2023. In 2019-2020, the year before the COVID pandemic, the figure was 21,242. The increase means more than 600 mentally ill children a week are deteriorating to such a state that they need reach a crisis point. The college said many of the children requiring emergency care Some suicidal or seriously ill as a result of eating disorders have been stuck on waiting lists for an average of 5 months, and in the worst cases, as long as 2 years. British MPs and health leaders said the National Health Service figures expose a devastating explosion of untreated severe mental ill health among children and should be a wake-up call for the government. They added there was now a serious risk that the alarming surge in children reaching crisis point before being able to access help was becoming the new norm. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Lade Smith, told The Guardian no one should have to watch their child's mental health deteriorate while they wait for care, adding, "It's completely unacceptable that this is the reality facing so many families." Dr. Lade Smith said ministers must take urgent action to provide targeted support to every child in need of mental health care and turn the tide on the country's growing children's mental health crisis. She added, "We want to provide young people with effective care as soon as they need it, not once they've already developed a serious illness which could have been prevented. That's why we need to see government focus on prevention and reversing the rising rates of mental illness, as well as ensuring sufficient resources of specialist services." British newspaper The Sun has also covered the same story and tells us more. Record numbers of children and young people in England are seeking help for mental health problems. In 2022 alone, 1.4 million were referred to child and adolescent mental health services for treatment of anxiety, depression, eating disorders and other psychological problems. But as demand soars for children's mental health care and support, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services teams are struggling to see or treat children quickly enough. Experts say that is leading to thousands of under-18s getting even sicker while on waiting lists, prompting a 53% rise in emergency and urgent referrals for Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services crisis care. An emergency referral is normally made if a child needs to be seen within 24 hours. Experts say they might be at risk to themselves due to suicidal feelings, have a significant health risk because of an illness such as anorexia, or have another serious mental health condition. Emergency referrals to Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services are mostly made by general practitioners and doctors in accidents and emergency departments, which are seeing rising numbers of mentally ill children arrive with nowhere else to turn, although schools and social services can also do so. Dr. Elaine Lockhart, the chair of the college's child and adolescent faculty, said, "It's unacceptable that so many children and young people are reaching crisis point before they're able to access care. We cannot allow this to become the new norm." Dr. Elaine Lockhart said, "Severe mental illness is not just an adult problem. The need for specialist mental health services for children and young people is growing all the time." She added, "Many of the conditions arising in children could be prevented or treated if prompt support and access to care were available." Dr. Elaine Lockhart noted, "The evidence shows us that children who receive support quickly are less likely to develop long-term conditions that negatively affect their education, social development and health in later life. Government and integrated care boards must commit to reducing the rate of mental illness among children by setting an achievable target. This needs to be backed by an expansion of the mental health workforce and additional funding for services." The college welcomed last year's government announcement of an extra £5 million to improve access to early support hubs for people aged between 11 and 25, but it said an extra £125 million to £205 million would be needed to establish hubs in every local authority, with running costs of at least £114 million a year. Laura Bunt, the chief executive of Young Minds, a child's mental health charity, said, "Every young person should be able to access the help they need when they need it. The government must prioritize young people's mental health and make it much easier for them to get support." Daisy Cooper MP, the Liberal Democrat health spokesperson, said, "This devastating explosion of mental ill health among children should be a wake-up call for the government. Conservative ministers have neglected children's mental health during and after the pandemic, leaving mental health services and families in crisis." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. A charity cautioned a worrying number of people taking time off work due to poor mental health leaves the United Kingdom at risk of becoming a burnt-out nation. The head of Mental Health UK has suggested global issues such as climate change and artificial intelligence fueling feelings of hopelessness could be contributing to burnout. It comes after a survey revealed more than a third of adults faced extreme pressure in the workplace in the past year. The YouGov opinion poll of 2,060 adults, 1,132 of whom were workers, found 35% had experienced high or extreme levels of pressure at work, with 20% requiring time off due to poor mental health caused by stress in the past year. Mental Health UK's chief executive, Brian Dow, warned the United Kingdom was rapidly becoming a burnt-out nation, with a worrying number of people taking time off work due to poor mental health caused by stress. He added, "High levels of work absence due to poor mental health are a major challenge, but its causes are complex." He continued by saying, "Public attitudes and understanding towards mental health and work have changed, particularly as the workplace transformed overnight in response to the pandemic." Dow stated, "Meanwhile, we live in unprecedented times and life outside of work has become increasingly difficult due to the cost of living crisis and pressures on public services. While global challenges such as climate change and artificial intelligence fuel stress, anxiety and feelings of hopelessness." Dow called on the government to intervene and better support the workforce. He advocated for a national conversation on the issue. Mental Health UK urged Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to hold a national summit to bring together ministers, employers and experts in an effort to create a healthy workplace and better support for workers. The Safe Pass to our ports.
Hajja Fatima was born in 1948. This was the year Palestinians refer to as Al-Nakba, the catastrophe, when Israel wiped the Palestinian inhabitants from 400 villages. Some they entirely destroyed, others were repopulated with Jewish immigrants. Hajja Fatima was born in a field while her father fought in the war. Within days of her birth, her family fled to Beit Anan in the West Bank, which is where she has remained her entire life.
بلدي مش بس احتلال 67.
First of all, this is my land and my country. It is not only the 1948 or 1967 borders from the sea to the river, 27,000 square kilometers. I am not ready to let go of a centimeter. This is historical Palestine.
Al-Quds.
Jerusalem, the most important one, the capital. This is Bab al-Shams and this is Bab al-Karameh. The Jordan Valley has been conquered and taken over by the Israelis. Here is Jenin. We will never let go of this area. And north is the Galilee, now ruled by Israel. My mother brought me into this world on the 14th of July 1948, the day of the Nakba. I was born in a field and left for 24 hours while my father fought in the war. I now fight with my words. Although this is my only weapon, I'm strong because I'm right.
Since her exile, Haji Fatima has witnessed dramatic changes in the landscape surrounding her home. From the construction of the Israeli wall, which eventually encircled her home, to the gradual building of Israeli settlements, which engulfed what was once Palestinian agricultural land. Her town was once considered the safest path to walk to the holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
The last time I visited Jerusalem, Al-Quds, was 7 years ago. But it is now forbidden by the Israelis. They forbid me from everything that I hold dear to me, praying in Al-Aqsa Mosque, buying sweet cakes from the old markets of Jerusalem, and walking through the ancient path of the old city. There is no place more beautiful than Jerusalem. I would love to be there just to see the markets, the shops, the old streets, and to pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque. Bab al-Karameh was built because it is the western entrance for Jerusalem. It is near Jerusalem, and this is why we built this village and named it Karameh. It means our pride.
Haji Fatima described the land to me, stating, "The land is our bed and the blankets our sky." Palestine to Haji Fatima is not exclusively about the land itself, but the Palestinians' relationship to their land. She told me that people can and will continue to live from the land, and only when their livelihood is taken, that will be the end of Palestine. Fatima sews each village and city into the map of Palestine, without borders, without boundaries, without settlements, without Israeli cities, and without the infamous wall built by Israel to separate what is now called Israel to the West Bank.
We want peace and they want peace. Our weapons is the rock and words. But we are rightful people. This is our land. Our ancestors are from here. Since 1968 they have been excavating tunnels, found a trace of evidence or antiquities. All of these antiquities are Arab, Muslim, Christian. We and our fellow Christians live together here. Jerusalem has the Church of Holy Sepulchre and it has Al-Aqsa Mosque. Whoever they want to imprison, let them imprison. Who they want to kill, let them kill. If they want to take a tree, we will plant 1,000. They break and we build. We are here for a long time. We are never going to be bored.
Thank you.
concrete in Palestine.
They asked me, why do you see Palestine like this? This is my country and I can draw it as I want and make it more beautiful.
Fatima joined Palestinian and international activists from around the world in building the protest village Bab el-Karama.
They didn't leave their land or houses and therefore they became refugees in their own homeland. Jerusalem is near, only a few metres from here, so we consider Beit Iksa to be the western gate for Jerusalem. If they take this village, we wouldn't be able to reach Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is our capital, the capital of the Palestinian state. Whether they like it or not, it's ours and not theirs. We are here today because they are going to take this land to build the wall through it, and we do not approve that. It is the land of our fathers and grandfathers, and also the land of our sons and grandchildren.
About 1,200 hectares of from Beit Iksa land, and it just leaves about 2,000 hectares for the city, for the village itself. This is what had happened, and this is what they are looking to do it. The train that passes from near here in this neighborhood was passed from the lands of Beit Iksa, and the Israelis want to keep the citizens here far away from the pass of the train and the wall. That's why they separate the land.
Well, I was at the Bab el-Sham's protest last week, and I myself had my head banged against a bus by a soldier. The bus I was put on to be taken away from Bab el-Sham's, there was a man with he had a busted eye and a bleeding nose, and the soldiers would not let him receive medical attention.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, Maliki Yawmiddin.
In this day, Al-Jum'ah, they pray here in their land because they know keeping their land is part of their religious and beliefs. For though here in Beit Iksa, the village that was surrounded by the wall from the whole parts, from the whole directions, only one path. This path is come and go through the gate that is run by the Israeli soldiers. If you want to enter, you have to give them your ID and tell them why and when you are come to enter Beit Iksa. This is the exact separation. Beit Iksa is living in a big jail here.
It's very clear that the settlements and the theft of land are illegal. The UN has repeatedly condemned it. Members of Amnesty International and other human rights organisations, they've all condemned it. It's just every attempt made to fix the situation is blocked by the US.
Ed Knight described to me that he barely sees the situation on the ground in the news, including settlements, construction and Israeli apartheid.
I think since the experience of the initiative of Bab el-Shams, it has been exposed the Israeli settlements much more and the Israeli confiscation of the land much more. It became have lots of interest in, within the international media, international community. And I think this is what we are doing now. If you continue this kind of initiative, they will challenge them more and more. And they will bring it from like in a kind of an media coverage to political levels. And that's what we want. We want everybody to be accountable and responsible for this. Because Israel is here, like any, by the support of Europe, by the support of the United States. Here they are accountable, as Israel is accountable for what's going on.
The villagers assembled for prayers on the hill. Following this, they erected a tent structure and laid the first bricks for a new mosque they call Karama, meaning dignity.
You know, Beit Iksa's land is confiscated, like any. Now have no land whatsoever. This is the last piece of land that has been confiscated, which is 450 dirhams. So the strategy here is to come and to build the tents, as you see here, and to stay in the land. So people is living, staying here, sleeping here, staying 24 hours in this land, telling the Israelis one message, the Israeli occupation. This is our land. We are not going to give it easy. You can give orders of like any confiscations, you can give orders of expulsion, but we are going to defend our land. We are going to stay in our land. And this is an open battle, you know, with the Israeli occupation power. So we have no choice but to resist.
This is very symbolic because back in 1948, when the state of Israel was established, the villagers here had 15,000 dulums of land. Right away, 14,000 of those 15 were taken away. And recently, they're trying to take away another 700 of the, so basically they're going to be left with 300 dulums. The village here needs more than that to survive. They have a lot of land that they need to grow food and survive on that. So the Zionist plan is to basically build a wall around the village and between the village and their lands so they can't grow, they can't use it for agriculture to sustain themselves.
Even with immense international support, Israel handed the activists a notice of demolition. They destroyed the mosque and ordered all people to leave the area.
We've been here for 3 days. They always come. Today, Israelis raided our village twice. Of course we prevented them, as we will do every day. At the beginning, they used to build the wall and we would follow them. But now it is the opposite. They follow us. That is why we are staying here. They closed the checkpoint and prevented anyone from entering. Days ago, the eastern gates of Jerusalem, Bab al-Shams, it is called that because the sun rises from the east, and this one is Bab al-Karameh. So instead of Israel surrounding us, we will surround them because we are the people with the rights to the land. The one who has the right is the strongest.
This area is agricultural land, you know, and now we are surrounded with the settlements. And this area, it's have in the history the main road to Jerusalem, and the Israeli settlements cutting this main road and cutting the main road to the Ramallah.
We have come here today to construct Canaan village on our land, our Palestinian land, to practice our right to develop our land, to plant our land, to use our land. This is our natural right as human beings, to use our land. That's why we are here today. When we arrived to the area, Israeli occupation or fascist Israeli occupation forces has attacked us, has demolished the tents, stolen the tents, but we are telling them clear message. They have demolished Canaan village here. We will today, not tomorrow, we will build another village in another area in Yatta, today.
We took the case to the High Court for petition to state that this is privately owned land. We were able to get an order from the High Court to not take the camp down for 6 days. However, the army stormed the camp under the pretext of security and announced it as a military closed zone for this period of time. I was shocked that I was unable to enter my own land.
Now we are living in miserable conditions. because we are cutting from the other areas from Ramallah and Jerusalem. We haven't any work. Our agricultural, all of our agricultural land now it's behind of the wall.
The Israeli soldiers told us it was a military closed zone until the 13th of February. I was shocked to see that he had a legal warrant from the head of the IDF to extend the matter to the 13th of February. After the end of the 6 days, the Israeli court granted the Israeli forces permission to take the tents down. This was permitted under a false and unreasonable pretext, security. The area is isolated. There are no Israeli highways or military bases, no danger towards Israelis whatsoever. It is open land. I strongly object to this excuse that it is a military zone. This is merely an excuse. This, for example, is a title deed from Turkey that proves that we are the landowners. This deed entitles Salah Ali Jirma and all the people of Tor to this land, which includes my family for generations. This title proves that these people are the rightful owners. Only the owners of this land have the rights to it.
Baba Shams was completely encircled by the Israeli army. All protesters were evacuated and Palestinians are now banned from the area. Although Mofid gained permission from the High Courts to remain on the land for an additional week, the Israeli police refused this petition and dispersed the protesters without warning or warrant.
2 weeks ago, there was an open day near the wall. We marched towards it and planted olive trees and buried with them the names of martyrs killed by Israel. The soldier attempted to stop us, but we continued digging. The soldiers came, but we did not allow them to destroy our work. We resist. Our work is on the land.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Members of two Palestinian families have filed a criminal complaint against German leaders for aiding and abetting the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, lawyers acting on behalf of two Palestinian families have requested that German federal prosecutors investigate Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck, Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock and Finance Minister Christian Lindner, among other officials, for providing the Zionist regime with weapons and political support and failing in their obligation to prevent Israel from committing genocidal acts. In a historic ruling in January, the International Court of Justice, ICJ, found that Israel is accused of committing genocide in Gaza and ordered a halt to all its potentially genocidal acts, a decision the Zionist regime has ignored. Lawyers for the Palestinian families said recently, German criminal law requires a ground for initial suspicion to start investigations on a potential crime being committed. The ICJ ruling clearly showed that there is such ground for initial suspicion when it comes to the crime of genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. The lawyer said that Germany has shown some of the strongest political and material support to Israel in its assault on the Gaza Strip and the Palestinians, with many German officials also inciting to genocide in their statements since October 2023. The case is being brought by the European Legal Support Center, PIPD, that is Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy and Law for Palestine, through organizations that are part of the Palestinian-led Justice and Accountability for Palestine initiative. Nora Ragab, one of the plaintiffs, said, "We, the living, must remember the dead in Gaza, tell their stories, and fight for justice. We, Palestinians in the diaspora, will not stand by and watch a genocide being committed against our families and our people. I lost family members in Gaza in November 2023. They were executed by the Israeli military while they were defending their homes," Ragab told a press conference in Berlin recently. German federal prosecutors have a history of shielding accused Israeli war criminals from justice, such as their refusal to properly investigate the Zionist regime's killing of a Palestinian German family in Gaza in 2014. But against the background of the ICJ decision, there may be growing international momentum to finally bring an end to this impunity. In a landmark ruling this month, for instance, a court in the Netherlands ordered the Dutch government to stop sending parts for US-made F-35 warplanes to the Zionist regime. And a federal judge in the United States accepted that the American government was aiding and abetting what he considered genocide in Gaza, but dismissed the case against Biden administration officials over their complicity in these crimes on jurisprudential grounds. Najia Samour, a lawyer on the German case who works for the European Legal Support Center, said, "Our governments in Europe have a legal obligation not to provide Israel any support in perpetrating the current genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. This lawsuit sends a clear message to German officials. You cannot continue to remain accomplices of such crime without consequences. We want accountability." Germany has made no secret of its full support for the Zionist regime's attack on Palestinians in Gaza, justifying Israel's genocidal barbarity and opposing calls for an immediate ceasefire. Chancellor Scholz and Foreign Minister Baerbock gave unqualified early support for the Zionist regime's massive indiscriminate attacks on Palestinians. Scholz, Habeck and Baerbock have invoked the claim of Holocaust as a reason not to oppose the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza, but to actually support it. Baerbock has also spread lies used by the Zionist regime to justify its direct and deliberate attacks on civilians. In its zeal to allow the Zionist regime's extermination in Gaza to proceed unabated, Germany opposed South Africa's application to the International Court of Justice that resulted in January's historic order to Tel Aviv to hold all genocidal acts. That prompted Hague Genga, the president of Namibia, whose people were the first victims of a German genocide in the early 20th century, to admonish Berlin. Genga, who died in early February, denounced Berlin's shocking decision to reject the morally upright indictment brought forward by South Africa before the International Court of Justice that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Genga said, in light of Germany's inability to draw lessons from its horrific history, the shocking decision to reject the morally upright indictment brought forward by South Africa before the International Court of Justice that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Germany has done more than cheer the Zionist regime's genocide from the sidelines. Between October 7th and early November, Berlin officials approved more than $300 million worth of military sales to Tel Aviv regime. That's 10 times more than Germany's arms sales to Israel for the whole of 2022. In a video posted by the German War Ministry on October 19th, days before the Zionist regime's ground invasion that would dramatically escalate its genocidal violence and destruction, War Minister Boris Pistorius assured his Israeli counterpart, Yoav Gallant, that Berlin would provide the Zionist regime continued military support. Meanwhile, Berlin bragged that it had begun a military airlift to Israel. At Christmas, members of the Luftwaffe, Germany's Air Force, even distributed traditional seasonal cakes to forces of Israel's Golani Brigade. The Germans evidently wanted to reward the Golani forces for perpetrating genocide against starving Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And this all flows from long-standing military cooperation between Berlin and the genocidal regime in Tel Aviv. For instance, the German military has previously boasted that it trains German troops in Israel to use Israeli-built drones that have been tested by killing Palestinians. Since October 7th, the German military has returned at least two of its Israeli-built drones to Israel to allow them to be used in the genocide in Gaza.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, economy is a key defining point. a strong economy is the strong point and the important factor in blocking domination and infiltration, while a weak economy is the Achilles heel that prepares the ground for infiltration, domination, and intrusion by the enemies. Poverty and affluence affect the materialistic and spiritual aspects of human beings. Economy, of course, is not an ideal of the Islamic society. Rather, it is a means without which one would not be able to fulfill the ideals. Insistence on reinforcing the country's independent economy that is based on mass and quality production, justice-based distribution, reasonable and waste-free consumption, and wise managerial relations, which I have repeatedly insisted upon time and again in recent years, are due to the incredible impact economy can have on the society's current and future life. The Islamic Revolution showed us the way out of the weak, dependent, and corrupt economy of the Pahlavi era. However, feeble performances have posed internal and external challenges to the country's economy.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The external challenges include the enemy's sanctions and temptations that would be rendered less effective or even ineffective if the internal challenges are resolved. The internal challenges consist of structural defects and managerial weaknesses. The main defects include economic reliance on oil, government interference in sectors of the economy that do not fit into the sphere of government's responsibilities, relying on imports rather than domestic strength and potentials, very limited exploitation of the country's human resources potentials, defective and unbalanced budgeting, and finally, lack of consistency in executive economic policies, disrespecting priorities, and excessive and even wasteful expenses in parts of state organizations. The result is problems in people's livelihoods, including the high rate of unemployment among the youth, low income of lower classes, etc.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Doza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Yemeni Office of the Presidency organized the first political forum to discuss the political, security and strategic implications and dimensions of the Yemeni pro-Palestine operations in the Red and Arabian Seas. Political and legal experts, academics and researchers from Yemen and abroad participated in the event.
The Red Sea battle led by Yemen in support of the Palestinian people within the Battle of the Al-Aqsa flood goes beyond imposing a siege on the Israeli entity and its interests in the region. Yemen draws a new equation and a new reality for the region. Today, the situation has changed, and Yemen is leading a battle that will have major effects in the region and liberate the region from American influence.
Participants underscored the importance of bolstering Yemen's naval operations, which have proven effective in impacting the Western economy, and in particular that of Israel, amid its genocidal war on Gaza. They pointed out the significant decline in activity at Israel's Eilat port.
Certainly, the military operations in the Red Sea strongly affected the Israeli economy, and this is acknowledged by the Israelis themselves. The ports were disrupted, the prices significantly rose, and it led shipping and insurance costs for commercial ships also jump. And this was reflected in the stability of the prices of basic materials and commodities in the occupying entity. Israeli industries were also greatly affected, and the losses were not limited to the economic level only, but included the strategic level, to the point that many Israeli projects were stopped, such as the NEOM project and other projects.
Since the onset of the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, the Yemeni armed forces have carried out dozens of naval operations against Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, imposing a blockade on Israel's maritime navigation. Yemen's Defense Minister Major General Mohammed Al-Atafi has hailed naval reprisal operations against Israel, stressing that the era of hegemonic influence of the United States and its allies on international waters is over.
Experts believe that the ongoing naval operations are not only a show of solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine, but also a move toward undermining U.S. influence in the region. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Syrian Journalists Union organized a central solidarity stand in support of Palestinian journalists at the General Organization of Radio and Television building in Damascus. The stand was in response to a call from the International Federation of Journalists to observe a minute of silence in mourning for the journalist martyrs who were murdered by the Israeli occupation since the beginning of its war on Gaza. At 12 p.m., all media workers across Syria stood in silence for a minute, holding signs condemning the blatant Israeli aggression targeting Palestinian journalists and demanding an end to the aggression on Gaza and the West Bank.
This stand by Syrian journalists and media professionals is an expression of our complete and absolute support for the Palestinian Journalists Union, the Arab Journalists Union, and the International Federation of Journalists. It is a call to document the Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists, as no other journalists in history have been killed in military confrontations like Palestinian journalists have been.
Syrian journalists affirm that Palestine is Syria's central cause, for which blood has been shed and sacrifices have been made. Today's stand aims to shed light on the systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists by the Israeli occupation, which has killed over 130 journalists since October the 7th. Participants praised the courage and sacrifices of their Palestinian colleagues who have replaced ink with their own blood in the pursuit of the just struggle and the honor of their profession.
These are the heroes who have been targeted by the occupation through assassination and bombardment because they have conveyed the truth about the massacres committed by the Zionist enemy. Today, Syrian journalists stand together in every newsroom.